Good morning, everybody. This is Suhail Sheikh speaking. I'm the CIO at Fulcrum. I think looking through the list of people who've dialed in, I've met many of you over the course of the last decade, slightly more than that. Nabil and I will go through a number of high-level topics that we've been getting questions on. I may just start with a couple of minutes, an overview of what we're up to here in this strategy, and then Nabil will spend 10 to 15 minutes on the macro views, and then we'd love to take as many questions as people have to throw at us. If I can start, please, on page 2, the key messages here are that we've been managing absolute return strategies at Fulcrum for about 12 years, and in that 12-year period, we've seen big ups and downs in stock markets and currencies and commodities and so on, and if you look at our broad performance, it's not obvious that we are dependent on any one direction in markets. It is true that this strategy is not a bear market fund, and neither is it a bull market fund. The key for us is if we see opportunities to make money, either on the long side or the short side, we will try and take advantage of them. So through the 2008 to 2009 period in the financial crisis, we were able to take advantage of a number of macro themes that we had identified. That said, between 2011 and 15, big bull markets in equities coming off significant policy support, decent valuations. We're again happy to take advantage of that. More recently, we've been more cautious, and we've been cautious particularly on the virus, but also on valuations. So as an absolute return vehicle, it's always difficult for us when equities are surging 10, 15% a year. But we've had the view that they've been borrowing returns from the future, and to a degree, Q1 of 2020 has given a lot of that back. So forward-looking from here, we'll go through our views in a moment. If I take you to page 3, very top-level, some questions we've had on Q1 performance. I think it's fair to say coming into the year, we were pointed in the wrong direction with hindsight. Fortunately, we were able to move quite quickly, but going back to January, the global economy looked very strong. Valuations were reasonably stretched, but not extreme on many equity markets. Volatility was low, and prices were generally trending in the right direction. But there was about a 2 or 3 week period where we felt significant complacency was embedded in financial asset prices, in particular currency volatility, commodity volatility, as well as in the level of many equity markets. So we turned the ship in the middle of February to become more defensive on equities, not to go short. We moved from about 25% in equities to about 15%. So it's important to note that throughout the whole of the Q1 and so far in April, we've had about 15% in equities, but this is not an equity approach. There are so many moving parts in currency markets and commodities and so on that we've generally been able to take a decent advantage of. One of them is with regard to precious metals, which for much of March actually ended up, they rallied, they gave it all back. If you look at things like the Japanese yen or even government bonds, defensive assets, if you simply held them, didn't actually make much of a contribution to your portfolio. This was an environment where trading slightly more actively, exploiting volatility, the whole array of investments that are in our universe was required to generate these returns. I'm pleased to say April continues in the same light, despite us remaining quite conservatively positioned, and partly that's a function of many markets being dislocated. So I'll hand over to Nabil to go into a lot more detail about all of these, and I'll come back for questions towards the end. Nabil.
Thank you, Suhail. I want to kick off by really summarizing our views on the current setting for the macroeconomy and financial markets. The page that you see on your screen, page 4 of the presentation, shows you consensus for advanced economies and global economies. Clearly here, a V-shaped recovery after a very large Q2 drop. That's the blue line that you see. Compared to 2008, very sharp drop, but also much sharper recovery that the consensus expects. Just to lay out very clearly where we differ in that outlook, we think that the risks are to the downside on the recovery side. So we think that by and large, the consensus is appropriately calibrating the drawdown that we're seeing in the economy with the shutdown. But on the recovery side is a tad optimistic, and I'll go through why we think that. And I think the other thing which is important here is that should the consensus, that blue line, be wrong, the room for policy support from here is much more limited. And I want to talk a bit about aspects of monetary and fiscal policy that give us a bit of pause in replicating the current support that we've had should the crisis last longer than we currently expect. The other thing that I want to touch on in the presentation is really the tracking element of Fulcrum. So Suhair spoke about the dynamism with which we've had to approach the portfolio over the last 3 months. That has been an extreme example of what we always do at Fulcrum, which is monitor the data that is relevant to markets and incrementally move the portfolio in the direction of the data that matters. And as we go through this presentation, I want to show you some examples of that. I won't do a page turner on you. I'll go through the key two, three key things that I think is important, and then go through the current portfolio and positioning and what we look at in terms of the opportunities going forward. So page five on the fiscal policy, everywhere in the world, on the left-hand side, the G10 forest fiscal response, on the right-hand side, the quantitative easing programs, all of them have been quite synchronized and quite rapid. That's good in our view. It was necessary to avoid a health crisis turning into a financial crisis. The monetary policymakers and fiscal policymakers have learned from 2008, and I think that the reaction has been in line. There are questions about whether it will lead to inflation in the future. We think the greater risk today is deflation, not inflation, and therefore the appropriateness of the policy measures that the policymakers have enacted have been good. They've been divergent. The US, the UK have been most aggressive. The euro area is still trying to get its act together with some of the political issues there, creating some dislocation across financial markets. And for emerging markets, the picture looks much more challenging. There, the fiscal tolerance of market participants, of bondholders, is likely to be something that we need to keep a close eye on. So as we look towards financial markets, the significant drop that we saw, and I'm here on page six of the presentation, really reflected the size of that drop. And the stabilization, we think, reflects the magnitude of policy response that was thrown at the problem and the V-shaped expectation of the consensus for the recovery. So we think that's going to be a very important element to watch for in the next 2 to 3 months, how the economy is performing, is it recovering in line? And I think the data surprises will really start impacting financial markets in a meaningful way. How do we do that? Page seven shows you our now casting for the US. So you can see here the black dots are the consensus estimates. The red dot is our path for activity. And then on the bottom charts, which I think are more important, the Q2 and Q3 now cast projections. So on Q2, the consensus has well calibrated, we think, and the data has confirmed that really a GDP Q-on-Q annualized of around 25% for the U.S. in Q2 is something that is reasonable. We think that that's in line with the recent data that have been published. But if you look at the right-hand side, bottom right-hand side of the chart, you see how that consensus black line goes to plus 10%, and our nowcast are at minus 10%. The reason for that is the consensus is currently embedding a switch-on, switch-off dynamic that does not have any cyclical latency to it. We think that when you have a drawdown in the economy that is this big, it does propagate beyond what can be controlled by a lockdown being turned off. So the labor market, the corporate sector, all of those things that actually will take longer to come back and will dampen the economy for longer than is currently being expected. We continue to watch the evolution of the data to ensure that we are responding with our positions accordingly. If we are right about the assessment, the issue that is quite important to us is that we are at a point where monetary policy has reached close to its limits. And on the left-hand side, you look at the nominal bond yields across the G3, and you look at the forward pricing of policy rates stuck at zero. This is the picture that we have seen in Japan for many years, but we're now seeing it in major markets, US, UK, and Germany. And you can see on the right-hand side a very similar picture on the proportion of global debt with negative yield. Importantly, the Fed and others have resisted going negative in yield because of the impact that it has on the banking system. We think that's appropriate. We think that, however, limits the potential for easing from here if the situation gets worse, creating downside for the economy. So for us, when you calibrate the financial market response to the crisis, significant drawdown, a liquidity shock that the Fed has really offset and thrown the kitchen sink at, and a limit to further cushioning of shocks, at least on the monetary side. And that creates a negative asymmetry to us on the financial market outlook. Very briefly, I'll talk about how we are thinking about the pandemic. Again, in the same spirit as our NACAS in economic activity, we're tracking the data at the global level on page 9, thinking about whether or not at the global level, this is a global phenomenon, individual country statistics do matter, but really we're going to be through this when the pandemic is in control at the global level. And on page 10, the blue dots show you the new cases at the global level, and they have stabilized but are not yet on a downtrend. And you can see how that looks on page 10, where it is on a downtrend, Italy on the right-hand side and clearly China on the top left-hand side. On the U.S., so this is the bottom left-hand chart, we can see some stabilization, similar to the U.K. picture where it is too early to say whether or not the cases have started to decline or to project zero new cases. On page 11, we have a range of scenarios, and I'll just say here a couple of things. One is that the things that matter are how long we're going to be in social distancing or lockdown for, because that's what creates a headwind for the economic activity. The things that stop us from being there, the ability to test, and the ability to have treatment and vaccines. Now, as we sit here today, we think that the testing needs to be much more ramped up in order for us to gain confidence in that being a solution. And the vaccines, as of today, look to be still 12 months away. They're still evolving. This for us is a framework that allows us to track information that we think is relevant. Finally, on page 12, the questions that I get asked, the markets have gone down. Expected returns surely have adjusted. Is it time to buy this market because expected returns are high? Our answer to that on page 12 with our expected return framework, yes, expected returns have gone up. They've gone up from 1% real to around 4% real for the equity market. This is about average since 1958. It is lower than you would expect in an environment that you are experiencing today, i.e. a recessionary environment. So while we think that expected returns have improved, the starting point of valuations and expected returns for equities were much lower than, for example, before 2008. Therefore, if we experience the kind of negative outlook that we see, we expect that to lead to significant further downside to equities and the upside being about normal. So how we position in the portfolio, we are clearly monitoring the recession that we think is upon us and investing in assets that protect us in that environment. We are paying a lot of attention to the effectiveness of monetary policy and how government bonds are, we think, unable to give us the real upside in those scenarios. So trying to find ways to express those defensiveness, find the yield convergence across various areas. And then not to forget that the geopolitical shocks that were with us in 2019, 2018, such as Brexit here in the UK, trade uncertainty between the US and China, the issues with the European sovereign debt crisis, are going to be there, and those fault lines are going to be exacerbated by the environment that we find ourselves in. We also, on the satellite side, are continuing to invest in teams that have, we think, been accelerated, and in tech disruption and other idiosyncratic areas, which I'll touch on very briefly. We think that those are areas of value in this market that you can buy strong earnings growth, accelerated thesis at lower valuations. So on page 14, you can see here, so there's the largest column in terms of risk allocation is the defensive, and we have the volatility area, which is we've been very active in, and then the global cyclical recovery. This is a balanced portfolio in terms of risk allocation. We're not just in aggregate, we think that the attractiveness of broad markets are not yet there. However, there are pockets of cyclicality that we want to access and alongside the broad variety of themes that we have. I want to go through in a couple of minutes those. So I'm on page 15. First one being dividend futures, which are very liquid and popular in Europe, less so in the United States, but we think offer value for this environment. So this is buying a dividend stream rather than buying the equity market, which gets you away from the multiple. And these have been dislocated in this market environment. So the, in the U.S., we think that the buybacks offer protection against dividend cuts. This is not the case in Europe. But we think that overall, the allocation to dividends as cyclical assets makes sense in the current environment as a long-term cyclical allocation. Page 16, a lot of themes, as I said before, have been accelerated by this coronavirus, COVID-19. We think that a lot of things that have been in place before this event have just gained momentum, and we've been invested in the tech disruption theme for the last 2 years. We think the environment is even better for this theme and have continued to allocate to that. In a long-only expected return setting, we think that investing in a portfolio of disruptors have an expected return of more like 15%. And then finally, my last point on page 17 is to say, when you have a recession, there is a reset of investments in various areas. What that does is create an environment where new areas benefit from fiscal policy or investment. And those typically are the focus of policy going in. In Europe and the debate in the United States, climate change has been a very important issue that has gained a lot of momentum. And we expect that as policymakers look to add fiscal policy stimulus across a range of areas, companies that have a better alignment towards the climate are likely to benefit. Those companies are across multiple sectors. And we think that this is an area for the long term that we will continue to allocate to. With that, I'll kind of stop here and open up for questions if anyone have any. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please unmute your line and ask away.
Just to remind you, if you want to unmute, you have to do #1. But Nabil, maybe there's a couple of questions which have come in. Maybe you want to start on one of those while we wait for other questions.
So the question that I see here is one on whether or not the degree of fiscal stimulus is setting us up for an inflationary environment in the future. Now I think that that's a good question, and it's one that is I think polarizing opinion in the current setting. On the one hand, you have people who say significant fiscal stimulus and currency debasement is going to lead to significant inflation 5 years from now, and others who say that the deflation environment, the demand shock, is going to prevail. We would say, today, we would be in the latter camp. We think that the deflationary consequences of this demand shock are likely to be much more significant than the inflationary consequences at this point, and that's what remains our focus at this moment in time. Gavin has written a really good piece about this in the FT over the weekend, which we'll be happy to share with you on that. The next question on the fact that equity markets have rallied quite significantly since the peak of the lockdown. So I think that the equity market rally, as I tried to express earlier, has really been a function of the significant policy stimulus and the perception and the realization that lockdowns do work as a strategy. So I wouldn't say that this has been the equity market rally has been unfounded. I think the basis for the rally is this monetary stimulus that has been in place and the peak in the, so if I just move to slide. Nine, that we actually have seen the data follow this path on page 10. In Italy, we've seen it in China, we're starting to see it in the US. And I think that's something that's encouraging people to see that actually we can calibrate how this impacts the economy. The uncertainty is, will we have a second wave? Will we have, will we be able to sustain the degree of reduction in cases without lockdowns? We think that the market has now discounted a lot of those scenarios and are looking through them. And to us, it seems that from here, the risks are to the downside.
#1, if anyone wants to ask a question, maybe 30 seconds. I think you might have one more question, Nabil, unless anyone else wants to speak up. We're coming up to the half hour. Nabil, the question was, should investors be following the buying programs of central banks? Should they be looking at leveraged loans and credits where the Fed's been active? I think that was broadly the third question we had.
I just saw the thank you, Paul. I think our broad answer to that would be, for us in general, the remit of following the Fed or being actually party to the assets where you have the Fed limiting the downside is not a bad strategy long term. However, this only works when there is a liquidity premium embedded in the market that the Fed is then taking away. So I think that was present in some parts of the high yield market, the loans market. Beyond that, as the liquidity premium normalizes, then really your expected return is much more a function of the defaults than they are of the liquidity that the Fed is providing. So in a recession environment, the focus has to be on the fundamentals and the default risk associated with those instruments. And I think that while the liquidity element, we get some protection from the monetary policy, without an assessment of the default risk, one should not simply just follow the Fed, because the Fed cannot stop the default cycle from occurring.
I have a question on your page 14, risk allocation by investment theme. Can you give us an idea what that translates into in terms of an asset allocation, not by risk, but by actual investment?
Sure. Maybe, Nabil, I'll handle that one. So if you think about the traditional asset classes in terms of global equities, global bonds, let's say commodities, and so on, I'll start with equities. Our net equity allocation in the portfolio is about 13% at the moment. You should put that into the context of a strategy that has peaked at about 45% in the past over the last 12 years and has troughed at about zero. So definitely on the more conservative end, driven by not particularly exciting valuations, negative momentum, high levels of volatility, and a big gap between our own forecasts of where economic activity and earnings may be going compared to what consensus is. So So that's not enough for us to go very negative, because valuations have improved. And in terms of the somewhat ugly contest between traditional government bonds and equities still look relatively interesting. So then maybe if I turn on to the government bond side, we have a slightly short duration stance. So if you simply are underweight equities relative to where you may be on average, and you then also jump into the bond market, you become a bit aggressively, a bit too conservative. And when we look at how low bond yields are, how close to zero they are in many parts of the world, and the amount of, I'd say, more technical money, fast money that is already long these markets, we don't see a particularly interesting return. We don't see particularly interesting returns from bonds. So we're about a year short duration in the portfolios. And it's interesting, what we're trying to do with government bonds is, rather than own them when the yield is so low, if our view is that bonds are not going to go too much in either direction, and yet volatility is somewhat elevated. So we're trying to generate income by selling volatility on bonds. So that's partly how we're generating some additional returns in the order of 10 to 20 basis points a month. Because we don't see activity accelerating, and even if it does, we see that the Fed will likely keep buying the bonds. So we see limited upside in bond yields, and at the same time, the zero lower bound, the threshold for the Fed, for example, to go negative is still very high. They may do it, but not without some serious market movements first. So on the bond side, very little exposure, slightly short duration, slightly short volatility. If I move to precious metals, again, in terms of context, we've been anywhere from minus 5 to plus 12, and currently we're at about plus 3. And then if I move on to the dollar is, of the four main asset classes, the dollar is the one that's hardest to call. If you even look back historically over the last few months, it's quite difficult to point to what drove the dollar up and down other than liquidity. At times. So our view on the dollar, if I talk statistically, the R squared we're able to generate on the dollar is relatively low compared to bonds and equities and commodities. So our dollar risk is relatively low. If we had to pick a stance on the dollar, we think if risk markets go down, the dollar goes up. So it's still a risk-off currency. But at the moment, we prefer to stay on the sidelines. In terms of oil, we remain slightly short. So we have covered quite a few of the short exposures in oil. We don't believe really the story about a big bounce anytime soon, because the oversupply is so substantial and is likely to last for a pretty long period of time. We have felt for a while that equities can bounce and oil could keep going lower. I.e., oil is not a risk on asset as such. It's very much dependent on local dynamics in Oklahoma and WTI, for example. And then if you go to the Brent markets, less problematic, but still significant oversupply. So we're about 1.5% short oil. That may sound like a relatively low number, but when something's moving around as manically as oil is, it's still enough to move the needle at the portfolio level. So overall, traditional asset classes not far off zero. How are we then generating returns? How are we taking risk? It is dominated, 80% plus of our risk is dominated by market neutral views, by long-short views. So own one asset class relative to another asset class. There is, in these periods of heightened volatility, there are a lot of opportunities in the volatility space. So about a third of the returns we've made in the last few months have been not only on the long volatility side, but also on the relative value volatility side. So it's quite difficult to translate that into an asset allocation. But hopefully that's answered your question.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Well, we have time for one last question. If you need to align it, #1 is to unmute your line and ask a question.
And if there are no more questions after that 10-20 seconds, then we're happy to take questions on email or have a call. We've tried to keep this call relatively brief, just respecting everybody's time, but if there's interest in more detailed explanations of our pandemic modeling, of our exact positioning, what we're doing on the volatility front, and so on, happy to discuss that offline.